Happy Thursday. You've almost made it to the end of the week. Thanks for staying with WGN Radio throughout the day. We love that you check in and listen in with us and that we get to spend time with you all day today. Let's go ahead and get started with Ian Scherer from CNET. He is the editor at large. He writes about social networking, VR, big internet companies, video games, parenting, and also cybersecurity, along with a lot of other topics. Hi, Ian. How are you?
Hi, how you doing? You make me sound so busy.
You are busy, and you are multi-talented, and you can write about just about anything. You're an expert on everything.
Definitely when it comes to the tech industry. I've been covering it for more than a decade, and at Reuters, at the Wall Street Journal, now at CNET. So I've had a good opportunity to see how everything changes over the years, and it's really helped me get an interesting perspective on it all.
Well, it's fantastic to have you on the show. Let's talk about 5G. Everyone seemed to be so excited about it in 2019, and boy, was it underwhelming.
Very underwhelming. And I think that's part of what the industry has realized, is that they kind of screwed up. And part of it was that when the rollout happened, a couple of things happened. AT&T, for example, a lot of us who have AT&T phones, if you look at your phone right now, it's a lot of them say 5GE, where it used to say 4G. And that's actually not true. It's not 5G. It's just kind of a slightly faster version of 4G. They were sued over that, claiming that they lied. And then we also had the rollout of 5G itself, which is supposed to be faster and more reliable and all this stuff. It only came out in a couple of cities, including Chicago, but not many. And so it was really rough. And let's not even mention that the phones themselves were very expensive. They were over $1,000. So this year, the companies say that they're going to learn from their lessons and they're going to have cheaper phones. They're going to be a little more clear about what the rollout looks like. They're going to be a little better about getting all this stuff online. And maybe over time, we're all going to feel like this was actually the revelation and amazing technology that they promised us. But it's going to be interesting to see what the next year brings us.
Well, do you believe it? You think it's really going to happen in 2020?
Well, at one point, it's going to definitely happen in the next year and a half, I think. And the reason is because on the roadmaps for all these phone companies, you're not going to be able to buy a 4G phone probably in 2021. So, they only have a certain amount of time left before all of the phone companies switch over. And then, Verizon, AT&T, Sprint, and T-Mobile, they all need to have 5G working. So one way or another, it's going to happen. The big question, I think, for us is whether we're going to be convinced of its value, because some of the companies are suggesting they're going to try and charge us more on our wireless plans to use 5G. And if they're going to do that, I need to be convinced it's worth it.
Well, let's stick with phones. You're saying that right now iPhone users can rejoice because Google Maps is getting an incognito mode. What is that and why do we need it?
Yeah, so one of the interesting things about Google is, you may be aware, that part of the way they make their money is that they track everything we do. They build up these very intricate profiles of who we are. Facebook does this too, by the way. Facebook thinks it knows your politics. So if you're curious to know what Facebook thinks your politics are, we have an instructions on CNET. But with Google, they're also tracking stuff like where you search and where you go and all sorts of stuff like that. And it makes some people uncomfortable. So Google, in an effort to make us all feel a little more comfortable, created this incognito mode, which supposedly shuts off all the tracking. You can do this on Google Chrome, by the way, as well as Google Maps. And now it's on the iPhone as well. Of course, I think if most people are upset with Google, they're not going to be using Google Maps anyway, but it is the most popular mapping app in the world, so it makes sense for them to do something to make us feel better.
Ian, I'm really excited about this because I am a bit nerdy, and I also would like to pretend to be a super spy or superwoman. I am hearing that in 2020, smart glasses may actually start to look totally normal and not completely dorky.
Yeah, I mean, we're going to definitely try, right? So there's this company called North, which makes a pair of glasses that actually look pretty decent now. We have been photos on CNET. And what they're doing is that they said that next year they're going to develop a version that looks almost like real glasses. Now, this is not like HoloLens from Microsoft that creates 3D images that you can interact with. This is much more like showing you a notification off the side of your eye. And it's nifty, but One of the things they say is that this is the first signs that we're getting to the point where the stuff is starting to look like normal glasses. And over time, the promise that everyone has, Microsoft, Facebook, everyone who's developing this technology, they say eventually you won't be able to tell people are using it, which I think will be cool, but also a little weird, right? Because I don't want to be wondering whether someone in a conversation is talking to me or looking at a video or watching a GIF or something. Like, that's going to be weird. So they're going to have to figure that out.
Will this actually make my life easier? And how much is it going to cost me?
So it costs a fair amount of money. You're looking at $600 for a non-prescription pair. Now, to be fair, normal glasses, when you walk into the store, can cost you like $300 to $400 on the low end. So, you know, it's not that much more. But I will say that that whether or not this stuff is going to catch on, I'm not sure. I think it's going to be a while. I think it's going to be part of it is that people have to be convinced this is worth it. And we also have all of these kind of societal issues, right? Like I brought up, am I talking to someone or are they busy on their phone while they're talking to me? I think we have to figure all that stuff out before people truly start using it a lot.
Well, these are all good points. Thank you so much to editor-at-large at CNET, Ian Scher. Now on the Wintrust Business Lunch, we have CEO of a Chicago-based company, Hazel Technologies. This is Aidan Moat. There's nothing worse than having a mushy banana or an avocado. It's so anticlimactic because you're the anticipation of having this perfect avocado, then you cut into it and it's ruined and you can't have your avocado toast. Very depressing. Am I right, Aidan?
Well, I mean, and that's not even the half of it. If you sum up all of those mushy avocados and those mushy bananas, you've got about a third of all the produce that gets harvested in the world every year never gets eaten.
We're definitely going to be talking about that. Let's first just tell everybody what Hazel Technologies does.
Absolutely. Hazel Technologies has a very simple mission, which is to prevent spoilage waste in the food supply system by providing unprecedented control of shelf life to growers, to retailers, and to consumers. So to achieve that, we've developed a proprietary biotechnology that allows us to store and time release active ingredients into the storage atmosphere of the produce. And by doing that, we can actually control the physiology of the produce. We can control the metabolic rate, the respiration rate, and that allows us to do things like preserve quality, preserve firmness, texture, flavor, nutritional value during storage and transit, as well as other benefits like fighting the proliferation of mold and fungus and other diseases that limit shelf life.
That sounded really fascinating, but I wanted to break it down into what exactly does it look like and how does it work? It's pretty simple because a lot of companies have attempted this, but you've done it in a very simple way. There are even small sachets.
Yeah. So I think you could argue that active packaging as a concept has been sort of the holy grail of the industry for a long time. And there's been many attempts at executing that. You got a lot of things centered around moisture control, a lot of things centered around oxygen control, and they're effective technologies, don't get me wrong, but they can only go so far. So what we said was, well, look, we have the ability to functionalize packaging materials themselves. We can take natural materials, things like wood, ash, sand, cardboard, paper, things like that, and we can use them as platforms to emit bioactive components. And we do that using very sophisticated chemical and physical controls of the material properties. So at the highest level, all the jargon that I just said comes down to we're able to make the packaging itself control the shelf life of the produce.
And it's easy and it's simple and it's accessible.
Well, you got to have that necessarily. I mean, there's lots of solutions out there, over-engineered, expensive, not necessarily all that environmentally friendly either. And what we said was, well, look, you know, the packaging is a natural consequence of having a supply chain. Everything's got to come packed in something. So why can't we functionalize that space, let the growers, let the retailers do the exact same things they've been doing throughout all of their operations, but do it now with an added layer of protection from within the supply chain?
What I love about this, you're not just talking about the producers and the growers, but you're also hopefully going to make it accessible for the consumers as well. Something
Absolutely,
that they
yeah.
can throw into their fridge. I know for me, I go and buy all of this produce at the grocery store that I think I'm going to be so good and I'm going to eat healthy and eat at home, and then all of it is rotted by the time it's time for me to actually cook it or eat it.
Yeah, no, 100%. I mean, and we've heard that story many, many times. So one of the great benefits of this kind of modularity, this kind of integrated approach, is what we envision as end-to-end protection. You know, anything we want to be able to protect it from the point of harvest, from the point of production, all the way to the point of consumption, and that includes the consumer household.
Well, you did mention food waste right at the beginning, and of course we do think about food waste in the supply chain, getting it delivered in time while it's in that perfect condition of being ripe but not rotting. The average American family throws away 25% of the groceries purchased. That's what I was just talking about. That costs a family of four an estimated $1,600 annually. So that's a lot of money.
Oh, yeah. And if you sum it all up across the supply chain, in the U.S. alone, we waste close to $100 billion in food every year.
So your company, and you started this with colleagues, these were all Northwestern graduate students?
Yep. We incorporated in 2015, March of 2015, and at the time, all five of us were students in various capacities at Northwestern.
And your offices are local. They are in the really cool University Technology Park?
That is correct. We are at 35th and State, which is the south end of IIT campus, and they run the UTP there. Which is a great facility, particularly if you're in a small company that does science.
Well, we love that you're homegrown. We love that you're staying here as well. The other part of this that's fascinating is you think about there's a huge business about spoilage prevention packaging, and that can be bad for the environment because it's a lot of packaging.
So, absolutely, yeah.
And your company can cut down on that as well.
Yeah, well, one of the things that's interesting about our approach is, you know, we provide the technology layer, right? So if you think of packaging as a technology stack, you know, there's always going to be somebody out there, they've got to put it in something. And what we're hoping for is to see a shift from plastics that traditionally have been deployed as a barrier in order to extend shelf life, and especially in things like fresh cut salads, fruits and things of that nature. And if we can provide that added technological functionality that actually provides that shelf life extension, all of a sudden you don't need to be using that kind of plastic. Now you can use a natural, you can use, you know, reprocessed paper, recycled paper, you can use wood, you can use cardboard, corrugated, things like that, which are more environmentally friendly.
Okay, so I'm going to the grocery store. I'm buying cabbage, strawberries, some cherries, bananas. What type of fruit and vegetables does this work on? And how long will this extend the life of the produce in my fridge?
Sure. That's a great question. So we have a number of solutions. We cover a pretty broad spectrum of crop. I would say pretty much everything at this point, but, you know, certainly all of your tropicals categories, your avocados, all your specialty fruit, even things as oddball as guava and star fruit and chayote and other things we've worked with before, melons, berries, temperate crops, so apples, pears, cherries, all the stone fruit, the fresh veg, the leafy greens, our technologies are good to extend the shelf life of. And what you're going to see, and you know, certainly there's two sort of regimes of effect. One is when you're in that storage and transit process, we can increase shelf life up to threefold of standard shelf life. But what's even more exciting and more to the point of the question that you just asked is the consumer wants to see what's going to happen post-retail. And that's a challenging situation because at retail, you've got warm conditions, right? You're shopping in a grocery store. That's when you start to see real spoilage problems. You've broken the cold chain. What's really exciting about the fact that we can control the physiology of that produce is that we can actually extend the shelf life post-retail and into the consumer space. So we're generally seeing 72 to 96 additional hours of shelf life at the post-retail shelf life area, so when the consumer has hold of the produce.
Aiden, I appreciate this. You're really going to be helping me out and a lot of the listeners.
Well, I'll do it for you.
Yes, just for me. So you've raised $18 million so far. You're all over the globe. Where do you see this going?
Well, you kind of hit the nail on the head already. Yeah, no, we've got quite a lot of support. We're active in about 12 countries so far. We've got plans to expand into that many again over the next couple of years. We've got new technologies coming out on the market constantly, so we've got a new product moving out into root vegetables next year that allows us to extend the shelf life of things like potatoes, carrots, onions, other sort of pantry-type vegetables. And we're even looking at non-crop uses as well. So one of the things that we're very interested in is adapting our packaging-based solutions to extend the shelf life of cut proteins, beef, chicken, fish, things like that. So you're going to see us in a lot of spaces.
So, Aiden, before I let you go, what's your favorite fruit?
My favorite fruit is probably the raspberry.
Oh, raspberry. Surprising. Okay, this was,
was a kid.
Aidan Moat, CEO of Chicago-based Hazel Technologies. Thank you so much for being in studio with us today. It is now time to take a break. Thanks so much for spending your lunch with us here on the Wintrust Business Lunch. Time now to check in with Amy Guth of Crane Chicago. Hi, Amy.
Hello.
I heard that you had a crazy busy morning.
You know, that's what's exciting about the Crane's Daily Gist podcast is sometimes you can walk in the door and say, okay, here are the four stories I'm going to talk about, and here's the person I'm going to interview, and the news breaks, and everything changes, and that's the joy of the business that we're in, and that was certainly the case today. There's been a lot of interesting news, but I want to talk first about the interview I did with Dennis Rodkin. Regular listeners will know and love him. He talked a little bit today about the new thing that that Penny Pritzker is doing with her husband. It's this fund. It's called the Chicago Prize, and 88, I think, people submitted proposals for ways to invest in the South and West sides. And so instead of being like helicopter and saying, I'm going to invest in a neighborhood, she went to community organizations and said, give me proposals. And so the six finalists have been announced. They were announced yesterday, and Dennis and I talked about that. I kind of want all of them to win. They're really cool things. You know, there's a recycling center. There's, I mean, all this cool stuff. There's like a health hub. There's just neat stuff. And I'm like, how, can everybody just win? Can you find more investors?
Don't the Pritzkers have enough money to finance all of them?
Probably. Well, what's interesting is so all the six finalists each got $100,000 and some consultancy help, some business development support to refine their idea to compete to be, you know, the overall winner. So even if they don't win, I mean, one person will win, but five others will be set up really well to apply for grants and things like that after this is over.
Well, I think that's super important because truthfully, we are a city of neighborhoods, but
yes,
the resources are not divided equitably to all of the neighborhoods. And that's very clear.
And that's exactly what she said yesterday in announcing this. The mayor was there. It was this big event. And, you know, and Penny Pritzker said, you know, I have to say opportunity is not distributed equally. And so let's address that and let's do something about it. So I think this is really interesting. And this is going to be a cool story to watch and see what the winner does and what the other finalists end up doing.
I guess as a journalist, you can't really tell us which one you're rooting for the most.
No, I mean, I said on the podcast, I'm like, I'm rooting for all of them. These are all great ideas that I hope win. That's the problem. So I even said, I am so glad I'm not a juror on this because I'd be like, can we just have more money to give away? I don't know. So yeah, that's a good one. But some breaking news in that space is that four hospitals that are mostly serving some of Chicago's poorest neighborhoods are in talks to consolidate. So all four of these hospitals are operating in the red, and consolidation could be an interesting idea, right? Because then there's shared federal resources. The downside is that it might, if you're a, say, cardiac patient and you go to a nearby center, you might then have to go to the only cardiac center in another area.
That was the immediate downside that I thought of as you told me the story is just the distance and how difficult it is for a lot of people that are suffering from injuries or chronic illness or maybe they're elderly, how difficult it is for them to actually travel.
Absolutely. And, you know, one of the things that could be consolidated under this plan would be obstetrics. And so if you're expecting a baby and you suddenly have to go very, very far away, that might change your plans quite a bit.
Any other pros or cons you see from this?
Well, I mean, the hospitals are all four of them operating in the red right now. So they really are under a lot of pressure under rising costs to kind of get it together and figure out a plan. So this would help them to be able to say, okay, we've all got some surgical equipment. What if we brought it together and had one really great surgical center? So, you know, the upside is potentially much better care. The downside is not very convenient for residents.
Got it. All right. What else is going on?
Well, also, we're talking a little bit today on there about Fritz Kagi, who is the Cook County tax assessor. Lots of consternation around his new approach. Joe Barrios had a very different approach to assessing property taxes. So Fritz Kagi came in and said, I'm doing this a different way and I want to make it more transparent. And a lot of people kind of didn't understand if the tax is going up this percent, does that mean my bill's going up this percent? There was a lot of conversation this summer when he did the first assessment on North Cook County. And so he's unveiled this really cool tool that you can plug in the three variables and kind of play with that data to get a better sense of like what your tax bill is going to be, what your property value is going to be, which is really valuable because in 2020, the South Suburban Cook County properties will be reassessed. And then in 2021, Chicago proper. So a lot of people are kind of, you know, there's been some speculation that maybe the real estate market is kind of slowing down a little bit for commercial investors because of this, because there's sort of some unknowns about property taxes, which could really clobber a lot of landlords. So that's kind of the big thing. And it's an interesting tool. Right now, it's mostly available to real estate professionals, but he is aiming at giving landlords kind of a better sense of what to expect, so it's fewer surprises.
And I'm guessing there's not a cost associated with being able to access the
program? Not that I know of. No, you go to the website and you can just access it right there and play with some data. And I think as a realtor, it would be a very good tool.
It's fascinating because we hear a lot about transparency from officials and politicians.
But it's this, the word. Yeah.
Yes, it's always promised but seldom delivered. But you think this is a good thing?
I do. I think it's a good thing because, you know, anytime there's misunderstanding, that's when, you know, tempers rise, emotions get really involved, people, you know, the market can dampen, the market can slow down, and we don't want to see that. We've been in a boom time, certainly in the West Loop. We've seen a lot of interesting real estate development. We want the, you know, economic thriving stuff to continue. So I think having people, equipping them with more information to make those decisions, hopefully, and this is what Kagi said too, that hopefully this will make this a more investor-friendly city and not scare investors off, if indeed that's what's happening.
It's fantastic to have a little bit more time with you. Do you have some other stories you want to talk about?
Well, sure. I mean, one I've been following so much is the ongoing Boeing story.
You've been talking about it this week.
Since the beginning.
Yes.
Boeing has been just such an interesting story. Well, now the new head of the FAA has gone before lawmakers and has been questioned. You know, he was careful not to throw them under the bus because he wasn't part of the organization then. But nonetheless, you know, there were a lot of really hard questions about accountability. And what's emerged is there was a study that the FAA did. Essentially, they predicted they would have several more crashes over the lifetime of these aircraft, and yet only warned the pilots. They didn't go further to say we should ground them now. That was after the first crash, but before the second one. And so when you look at the number, you're like, oh, more crashes. What is this? And you look at the number, it's almost 3,000 more people were predicted to be, you know, statistically would die in a crash in one of these aircraft if zero fixes occurred.
How did that happen?
I know, which is exactly what lawmakers are asking. They're kind of going, how in the world is your solution to just tell pilots? So they're battling out a little bit of inconsistency there. Some of the lawmakers are saying we definitely want to propose some legislation for tighter controls around how the FAA will certify aircraft in the future and how they'll interact with manufacturers, because that's really what's under scrutiny, is that in many cases, the manufacturers to some degree were allowed to self-certify. And that's, you know, the honor system, it's never always going to work, right? So that's kind of what we're looking at. It continues to unfold, but that's a story that I'm watching and I talk about a bit on the Gist today because, I mean, when you look at the number, almost 3,000 people, that's very significant. And I think that was something noted early in that story. You know, shortly after the second crash, I was talking with Claire Bushy, who's a reporter at Cranes, and I asked her, you know, what are people missing about this story? And she said, well, this quickly became a business story about this local company, Boeing. But at the end of the day, 346 people lost their lives in these two crashes because of cutting corners, because of oversights, because of, you know, putting dollars before human beings. And that's really the story here. And the fact that, you know, perhaps a company was able to, or was considering doing that further. I mean, any aircraft has its risk, but when you see that number, it's kind of like, yikes, it's kind of a gut check.
It's such a tragic story to think about those lives. Is there blame to be spread around here, or are you thinking that it belongs to a certain department or individual?
That remains to be seen. There were two whistleblowers that were also brought into the conversation in front of lawmakers. You know, one complained about major pressure to cut corners at a manufacturing plant here in the U.S. and I think it was in South Carolina. You know, things like that that are emerging. So the FAA chief said that they are considering some sort of action against Boeing, but it remains to be seen what exactly lawmakers are going to do, you know, when we're talking about this House committee that's doing this questioning. So they've already questioned CEO Dennis Muilenburg, and you know, there was a 6-hour session yesterday. We'll see what happens in the days ahead and as it continues, but we'll see.
Tragic story, and it's going to be fascinating to see how it unfolds. And of course, we're going to be seeing a little bit more of you in just a little bit, because you're going to be filling in for Anna DeVellantis.
That's correct. Right. I'm just going to go switch hats and go
I
do that.
I love that.
Guest
to
host.
You're a multitasker. Thank you so much to Amy Guth for being here in studio with us for right now. Dominguez is here. He is with ComEd, and you are going to be telling us about a fantastic resource fair that is happening this weekend. Where is it happening, and when is it?
It's great. Thank you. Yes, the event is taking place this Saturday, December 14th. It'll happen at the Summit Park District office, which is 5700 South Archer Road in Summit. It takes place from 9 a.m. to 1 p.m. And any resident is welcome to attend. ComEd is teaming up with Nicor Gas to provide information on utility bills, financial assistance options, as well as energy efficiency tips to help them save on future bills.
So if someone is having trouble, or they know they have a friend or a family member having trouble paying their energy bills, there's going to be help available at the fair.
That is correct. We will have representatives there who will be able to look up people's accounts to find out where they are in the system. If anybody's having problems right now, we have bill paying options to help to make it more manageable to pay it down. We have information on assistance options between now and the end of the year, as well as in 2020 if we need to provide grants to folks. And again, as well as information on saving energy, including distributing free energy saving kits.
What are in these energy saving kits?
I'm glad you asked. These kits have energy saving devices in them, like advanced power strips, LED light bulbs, low flow kitchen and bathroom aerators, low flow water shower heads, and LED night lights. And all these things, if you were to use them, use less electricity. So hopefully you will see your bill lower in the coming months.
And Thomas, tell us what sort of documents do folks need to bring to the fair to make sure that they can get the help they need?
Definitely. Certainly a proof of your current day or your current 30-day gross income, you know, tax forms, a copy of your most recent natural gas or electric bill, proof of your Social Security numbers. If you are in a rental unit and your utilities are part of your rent, just proof of your rental agreement that shows that. And then if you happen to be a recipient of TANF, just a medical eligibility card.
Well, fantastic. This is Thomas Dominguez from ComEd. And tell the listeners where they can find more information about this weekend's fair.
Certainly. All the information on all the different options are on the ComEd website, comed.com.
Well, thank you so much, Thomas. The news is next from the Northwestern Medicine Newsroom.